We're in Genesis. And the last time we left off, we actually left off with Judah. But what a blessing for Jacob, you know. Here he is on his deathbed. No better place to be than on the next step into eternity, right? And we see him giving blessings to his sons and how gracious the Lord has been to him. You know, we see, if we look at Jacob's life, boy, if you don't see grace, the grace of the Lord in his life, I think we're missing out on something there special. Because, boy, did this guy deserve the wrath more than the grace most of the time? You know, the stupidity and the deception that he, the life that he led in some instances, but the Lord's grace is what brought him to himself, you know. And now you see it and you think, wow, here he is, you know, at the end of his life, just being able to sit down and bless his sons, and he would take them in order. And I don't know, by this time, you know, as they heard Reuben's fate, in a sense, they heard Levi and Simeon's inheritance. They become pretty weak in the knees, you know. You think, oh, gee, do I really want to hear mine? You know, and that's how we get sometimes. When the Lord's showing us something, you know, you go, Lord, I don't know if I want to hear anymore. You know, I remember when we came down here and took the little tour around town just to pray on it, you know, just praying and coming down and saying, Lord, do I want to see any more? You know, sometimes we don't, you know, sometimes we get to that point where we're like, I don't know, Lord, you know, I don't know if I want to see any more. And I think, you know, you got to say, as you're standing in line and they're going down to birth order, and of course, we see Zebulun here. They actually go out of birth order here a little bit with Zebulun. And he must be thinking, okay, what's next for me? You know, what's next for me? And so Zebulun, it says, shall dwell in the haven of the sea, and he shall enter a haven for ships, and his borders shall adjoin Sidon. So we see Zebulun here, and we know that it would be a place that was settled between the land, actually sitting in between the Mediterranean Sea and the Sea of Galilee. So we see that. Matter of fact, we know that Zebulun was probably one of the most faithful to David as far as fighting for him. You know, largest number of soldiers in David's army there was from Zebulun. There was 50,000. First Chronicles 12 would tell us that. And Zebulun there would actually, the literal translation there would mean looking towards the sea. It was a place in which probably it seemed like the commerce happened between the Sea of Galilee and the Mediterranean, and it would pass through the land of Zebulun. And so, richly blessed just from the, wasn't shippers themselves, weren't sailors themselves, but just kind of reaped the benefits of being that land and in between there in the Galilee. And so then verse 14 says, Issachar is a strong donkey. I don't know. He might have said, Dad, could you stop there, you know? I mean, if your father said, you're a strong donkey, would that make you feel real good? Probably not, you know. I'm sure that the King James has a different translation to that than donkey. I got a suspicion. But yeah, he was a strong donkey lying down between two burdens. He saw the rest was good and that the land was pleasant. He bowed his shoulders to bear a burden and became a band of slaves. He was a strong donkey. You know, Issachar was a large tribe. It was third in size, according to Numbers 26. Their size, they were large in size and they had abundance. But it was typically a route for foreign armies to come through, and often they experienced their oppression and became their servants, in a sense. The meaning here of Issachar seems to indicate that they were strong in number, but they were actually pretty lazy. The Lord gave them this land, but it wasn't something that they enjoyed or they protected or strived in, but they ended up being the ones that were the servants of the ones that came in, the strangers to the land. They became the servants of. So it's kind of interesting here. It says he saw the rest was good and that the land was pleasant. But the latter part there says that they became the slaves and a band of slaves, really. So even though, you know, sometimes the Lord does bless and He gives us His abundance, right? But in the same token, He wants us to use it for His glory, and plus He wants us to be good managers of it, you know. Good managers of it. And then 16, Dan shall judge his people. As one of the tribes of Israel, Dan shall be a serpent. Boy, you know, it only gets better from here, from a donkey to a serpent. And we kind of know who the serpent was. By the way, a viper by the path that bites the horse's heels so that its riders shall fall backwards. The report here for Dan wasn't necessarily the best. A serpent by the way said that Dan shall judge his people. The tribe of Dan you'll find in Judges 13 was Samson. Samson came out of that tribe. But it was a troublesome tribe. We find that Dan introduced idolatry to Israel in Judges 18. We find that Jeroboam set up one of the idolatrous golden calves in Dan in 1 Kings. And if you go over to Israel today and you go into Dan, you'll find that there's artifacts there that they find that they would have altars that were probably as big as this section of pews that they would sacrifice to their false gods. You know, very, very idolatry minded people. Later, Dan and Amos 8, right? You'll find that it was the center of idolatry. It was the place where everybody, it was kind of like Las Vegas today, Sin City. What do you think of, right? You think of sin. Well, back then, Dan was the center of the idolatry. If you wanted to sacrifice to your foreign gods, you would go into Dan, and that would be the place in which you'd go to do that. It was socially accepted in a sense, right? Just as we would say about many cities here today. Some think that the serpent, by the way, refers to the idea of the Antichrist that would come from the tribe of Dan, based on Daniel 11 and Jeremiah 8, verse 16. Some think that. Some seem to refer to that idea. If you look at Revelation chapter 7, we find that the mention of the 12 tribes there, the one that's left out is Dan. So out of the 144,000, we see that Dan would be left out of there. But, you know, one of the things that we know about the Lord, He is a Lord of second chances and third chances, and often He has opportunities. And it seems like in Ezekiel 48, it would seem that this tribe is called out in the, as being part of the millennium. So you wonder, did the Lord give them a second chance here, you know, even though their idolatry was rapid in there. And it gives us this wonderful sign of God's redemption, you know, how what he does there. You know, we get discouraged, don't we, when we look at folks and we think, boy, is God going to give up on them? He's given them so many chances, but that's the way He is. He does. But Dan, it says, Dan shall be a servant, a serpent by the way, a viper by the path, that bites the horse's heels so that its riders shall fall backwards. It gives us an illustration there that this biting of the horse's heels, almost, you know, what idolatry does to a person. It kind of bucks them off, you know. It makes the horse rear up and fall backwards. It's never a good thing, you know. Idolatry isn't. In verse 18, it says, I have waited for your salvation, O Lord. And the word for salvation is Yeshua, which is translated, obviously, as Jesus here. I'm waiting. Waiting for Jesus. Waiting for that salvation. O Lord, the promise of Christ in someone's life. Then there was Gad. There was Gad in verse 19. Gad, a troop, shall trample upon him, but he shall triumph at last. The tribe of Gad supplied many troops, many good troops to David. We would learn that in Chronicles 12 as well. In the days of Jeremiah, the foreign armies were oppressed Gad, Jeremiah 49, which tells us that they were trampled there. It says, and Gad, a troop shall trample upon him, which was in Jeremiah 49, verse 1. Not great prophecies, not something that we would, you know, we look at some of these prophecies, we think, boy, you know, would we want to be receptive of these? Would we want to be part of these tribes, you know? It's a tough way to be prophesied. Every time we want to be prophesied on, right, we say, we want the good news, Lord. We want the good news. But again, this is some of the stuff that comes not just from them, but it comes from the life of Jacob here, you know. He brewed some of these. This is what happens when our homes are disordered and whatnot. And then there's Asher. It says the bread from Asher shall be rich, and he shall yield royal dainties. Royal dainties. In Deuteronomy 33:24, Moses again took up a prophecy regarding Asher. And Asher is most blessed of sons. Let him be favored by his brothers, and let him dip his foot in oil. You know, as a richness, he shall be rich. You know, it could be that could it be that he has something to do with baking or whatever? But it says, and it gives us the impression that he shall yield royal dainties. There's something that's there that gives you the impression that he's yielding dainties for the royalty there. And then Naphtali is a deer. Let loose. He uses beautiful words. Beautiful words. So this was located up by the Galilee, the region where Jesus did most of his teachings, most of his ministry. And it is interesting here that it would say he uses beautiful words, you know. Of course, Jesus, as he ministered in that region, used beautiful words. His words were good, of course. Now, when Jesus heard that John had been put in prison, he departed from Galilee. And leaving Nazareth, he came and dwelt in Capernaum. And we know that in that region of Zebulun and Naphtali was where Jesus performed much of his ministry. A lot of his ministry came out of Capernaum. And Matthew would say the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali by the way of the sea, including the Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles, the people who sat in darkness have seen a great light, and upon those who sat in the region and the shadow of death, light was dawned. So in this region, Jesus, God in the flesh, would come and reveal the light of the gospel there. Naphtali. And then, of course, the longest section here is somebody that we're pretty familiar with, I would hope, by now. And that is Joseph. Joseph. It says, Joseph is a fruitful brow, a fruitful brow, as a fruitful brow by a well. His branches run over the wall. The archers have bitterly grieved him, shot at him, and hated him. But his bow remained in strength, and the arms of his hands were made strong by the hands of the mighty God of Jacob. From there is the shepherd, the stone of Israel. By the God of your fathers, you who will help you, and by the Almighty who will bless you, which blessing of heaven above, blessing of the deep that is beneath, blessing of the beasts and the and of the womb, the blessings of your father have excelled the blessing of my ancestors in the utmost bound of the everlasting hills. They shall be on the head of Joseph and on the crown of the head of him who was separated from his brothers. A fruitful bow. A fruitful bow. Kind of brings to, you know, just the kind of sums up his life, right? He was fruitful. in what Joseph did, he was fruitful. I mean, we know in chapter 48 of Genesis here is that he received a blessing. He received a double portion of blessing. And of course, you know, we see the archers here. The archers have bitterly grieved him through David's life, right? He was grieved by others. His brothers who threw him into the pit hated him, right? It says that they shot at him and hated him. But his bow remained in strength. He still hung on to the Lord. You know, that was his strength. The idea here is that God's hands were Joseph's hands. You know, and that what Joseph put his effort into was because God was in it, you know. When we looked at Joseph and we saw him in prison with the baker and the butcher, or the butler, I'm sorry, and the, what was the nursery rhyme? And we saw him in prison there, you know, and he put his hand to just being a servant to them. You know, it was the Lord's strength that in his hands that allowed him to do that, because in the flesh he would have never done that. In the flesh we would have took pity, he would have took pity and not done it, right? Like the rest of us. But it is the strength of the Lord that allows us to do the abnormal. You know, if you look at Pastor Saheed, right? And it's same kind of thing, right? The only way he's going to be productive in that prison really is that he allows the Lord to do it, to strengthen him. We see his feebleness. We see his weakness in the flesh. Seems like he's having health problems. Well, the only way he's going to get through and be successful in the Lord is to let the Lord strengthen him, you know. And that's the way we are too, you know. If we put all our strength and effort into ministry, well, it usually comes to naught, right? It's when the Lord strengthens us, it's when the Lord sends us out, right, that something happens. It says the Almighty blessed him. And by the Almighty who will bless you, right? Joseph was certainly blessed. We see that as even in material things. Because of his obedience in the lesser, you know, when he was in prison, his obedience there, you know, the Lord just continued to bless him. Even when he entered the prison, there was favor that was involved there. And so we see the blessing of Joseph there, and of course the blessing of your father has excelled the blessing of my ancestors. Joseph, or Jacob, could say this because he was, for which of his life, a scoundrel. He was a scoundrel. But now he's saying, the blessing of your father have excelled the blessing of my ancestors. He knew that at the end of his days, he saw that God was good, right? When Joseph came back to him, he said, wow, the blessings of your father excel the blessings of my ancestors. And he sees the forgiveness of the Lord through that too. Verse 27, we have Benjamin as a ravenous wolf. In the morning he shall devour the prey, and at night he shall divide the spoil. not something that you necessarily would like to be called, a ravenous wolf. It seems like this tribe had a reputation of fierceness. We see a few people that come out of this. We saw Saul, right? Saul in 1 Samuel. King Saul. And we saw some of his characteristics as he went after David. And we can't forget that Paul, or Saul, the Apostle Paul, came out of this line of Benjamin. And we see some of the things that he was involved with, the killing of the Christians, right? The persecution that he was involved in. So, ravenous wolf. It seemed like this tribe was cruel. It had a cruel streak in it. In all these things, the 12 tribes of Israel, and this is what their father spoke to them, and he blessed them. He blessed each one according to his own blessing. I must say that I don't know, I don't think I would delight in many of these blessings, They were called blessings. But he blessed them right at the end of his life. Here it says some of the things mentioned regarding these tribes may seem a bit cloudy, someone wrote. But only because we may not know exactly their fulfillment until the age to come. So sometimes when we look at these prophecies and we say, gee, these are hard things, These are hard things to say, but the Lord uses these just as he would use Judah, right? We look at Judah's life and we see that he wasn't necessarily the most behaved guy. He was the one member that would give up Joseph to the Midianites, would want to sell him off to be profitable. But it was Judah that the Lord would come through at that time. We looked at Judah at lunchtime with the kids, and Judah was a very bad nation at times. The Lord said that that the nation of Judah there was, they forsook the Lord. They didn't pay their mind to him. They didn't really pay attention to him, Didn't listen to him. But it says here, all these 12 tribes of Israel, and this is what their father spoke to them. And he blessed them. And he blessed each one according to their own blessings. Then he charged them and said to them, I am to gather to my people, bury me with my fathers in the cave that is in the field of Ephron the Hittite, in the cave that is in the field of Machpelah, which is beyond Mamre of the land of Canaan, which Abraham bought with the field of Ephron the Hittite as a possession for a burial place. There they buried Abraham and Sarah, his wife. There they buried Isaac and Rebekah, his wife. And there I buried Leah. The field and the grave that were purchased from the sons of Heth. It's interesting here, I think, is that here he is. He's going to get buried with his father. They bring him out of Egypt. He knew that it wasn't to be in Egypt that he would be buried, but he'd be buried with his fathers. But he could have been buried in Egypt. He would have got, you know, the royal treatment, as we'll learn, I think, in the next verse there. He was a son of the promise of a covenant of Abraham, that he would be buried in the land of promise. I find it interesting here is that it says in verse 32 that the field and the cave that, I'm sorry, in verse 31 it says that they buried Abraham and Sarah, his wife, there. They buried Isaac and Rebekah, and they buried his wife, and there I buried Leah. You know, Leah is the one that he didn't really want, right? He's the one that he took because he wanted Rachel, right? But here he mentions Leah. It was almost like he was honoring her because, you know, his heart had changed toward her. Through this whole process of grace with the Lord, I think his heart changed for Leah. Because at the beginning, he was still the deceiver, right? But as he went through his life and he saw the blessings of the Lord and he saw God's hand of grace upon him, we would find that he had a heart for Leah, who was maybe put aside or had played second fiddle so much. But he would bury her in that tomb. Then 33, and when Jacob had finished commanding his sons, he drew his feet up into the bed and breathed his last and was gathered to his people. So here he would breathe his last. So we see the end of the life here. Probably the last great patriarch that we know, Jacob. God would continue to raise men up. It wasn't just Jacob and that was it. But God would continue to raise great men up throughout the Bible, as we think of those like David, that he rose up. And he was gathered to, Jacob was gathered to his people. His people. Then Joseph fell on his father's face and wept over him and kissed him. And Joseph commanded his servants, the physicians, to embalm his father. So the physical embalmed Israel. The physician embalmed Israel. 40 days were required for him, for such are the days required for those who embalmed. And the Egyptians mourned for him 70 days. So this embalming process was quite unusual. You know, we don't really think about it today so much. We look at that embalming process and we know it happens and a person dies, they get embalmed, but we don't think about it as they did, you know. They would take out many of the organs out of the body, including the brain, and they would leave there the heart and the kidney, whether they felt like that there was some sort of usefulness after death for those type of things. You know, the Bible says a lot about the heart. So maybe it was a something that they were wondered, is it useful for the afterlife, you know? So they would leave the heart and the kidneys. But here it's interesting because they mourned for him for 70 days. You know, as far as Egypt was concerned, Jacob was just a little less than royalty. He was just a little less in position as say the Pharaoh, because the royalty in them days in Egypt would be mourned for 72 days. So two less days for Jacob just places him just under. And if we look at Joseph was second in command, so therefore the father of Joseph was, in a sense, second in royalty, you know. So very highly thought of in the nation of Israel there. It says, now in the days of his mourning were past, Joseph... another thing that's interesting is that Joseph's love for his dad, even though they were apart for so long, he never stopped loving his dad, you know. All these years, his extended years. Sometimes an extended years don't necessarily draw people together. It draws people apart, you know. I think of some of my family members, I'm not so much drawn to them anymore because I've been away from them so long, you know. But God kept that fervent love for his father in his heart. Almost an unnatural thing, right? Almost an unnatural. Yeah, do you love your dad and he lives way over yonder, but you don't know him, you know. But here, Joseph is such a distance from him, but he still loves him. And it reminds me kind of the Lord. Sometimes he does feel distance from us, right? We're in this physical body and he's in the spirit, and even though his spirit lives within us, we sometimes do feel a little distance from him. But we still love him. We still have the passion for him, you know. Verse 4, now when the days of his mourning were past, Joseph spoke to the household of Pharaoh, saying, if now I have found favor in your eyes, please speak in the hearing of Pharaoh, saying, my father made me swear, saying, behold, I am dying in my grave, which I dug for myself in the land of Canaan. There you shall bury me. Now, therefore, please let me go up and bury my father, and I will come back. And Pharaoh said, go up and bury your father, as he made you swear. And Joseph went up to bury his father, and with him went up all the servants of Pharaoh, the elders of his house, and all the elders of the land of Egypt, as well as the house of Joseph, his brothers and his father's house. Only their little ones, their flock and their herds were left in the land of Goshen. And there went up with him both chariots and horsemen, and it was a very great gathering. Then they came to the threshing floor of Eted, which is beyond the Jordan, and they mourned there with a great and very solemn lamentation. He observed 7 days of mourning for his father. And when the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites, saw that the mourning at the threshing floor of Atad, and they said, there is a deep mourning of the Egyptians. Therefore, its name was called Abel Mizraim, which is beyond the Jordan. So his sons did for him just as he had commanded them. For his sons carried him to the land of Canaan and buried him in the cave of the field of Machpelah before Mamre, which Abraham bought with the field from Ephron the Hittite as property for a burial place. And after he had buried his father, Joseph returned to Egypt, he and his brothers and all who went up with him to bury his father. So after the death here of his dad, he would make good on his promise there to go up and bury his father. Luther would remark that there was no burial recorded in Scripture quite as honorable as this, or with such wealth of detail. It says the mourning there was great, and it was very solemn. And so we see the burial of his father and his dedication to his father to follow through right to the very end, even if it means being inconvenienced, right? And then in verse 15 it says, when Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, "Oh no, perhaps Joseph will hate us and may actually repay us for all evil which we did to him." And so there's this worry about what will be the consequence now that Dad is gone, and will he hate us? And they feared that Joseph would turn on them after Jacob's death. And it seemed to be probably a very it seemed to be reasonable, right? Because you treat somebody bad, and if they have a occasion for revenge, they might just do that. But that wasn't the character of Joseph. Joseph wouldn't repay him for evil. But they were beginning here to acknowledge the evil that they had caused. They understood it. They knew it, and the consequences might be that their brother would turn upon them. So they sent messengers to Joseph, saying, "Before your father died, they commanded, saying, 'Thus you shall say to Joseph, I beg you, please forgive the trespasses of your brother and their sin, for they did evil to you. Now please forgive the trespasses of the servants of your God of your father. And Joseph wept when they spoke to him. Then his brothers went and fell before his face and said, 'Behold, we are your servants.'" Seemed like they were groveling here a little bit, as they would send messengers to Joseph, almost afraid to confront him on their own. And we do that as they did. We do the same, right? We have a tendency of, if we're afraid to confront somebody, we sometimes people will text, you know. They'll text and they don't want to say it to your face or whatever. But they were scared that maybe there this consequence. And then they said that thus you shall say to Joseph, "I beg you." You know, they said before your father died, he commanded saying this, right? But we don't see that. They're kind of making it up for their own fright, right? They don't want to really. They're trying to make it so, hey, Dad said this, so you gotta do it this way. Almost like their will. Well, Dad left this to me, said that I could have those guns when he died, and instead it's written in the will, "No, you don't get the guns," kind of thing, right? Same kind of thing here, is that they're trying to make up the story so that they're favored with Joseph here. But you know, they didn't need to do all this. Joseph said to them, "Do not be afraid, for I am in the place of who? Of God." Am I in the place of God? Am I the one that's going to judge you? You don't have to fear me, he said. You have to fear God. He's the one that's got the final call on your life. "But as for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, in order to bring it about as it is this day, to save many people alive. Now therefore, do not be afraid. I will provide for you and your little ones." And he confronted them and spoke kindly to them. He said, no matter what you turkeys tried to do, God was going to have his way here. You don't have to worry about it. Even though you meant it for evil, God meant it for good, and God worked it all out. And so for us, you know, Joseph didn't have the text there from Romans 2:28 where it says that he would work out all good to those who love God, right? They didn't have that verse, but it was the same application here, right? God's going to work it all out. No matter if somebody thought bad of them or evil of them, don't worry. God's going to work it out. God often tells us, don't worry about it, you know. Don't get anxious about this. Be anxious about nothing, right? And sometimes people disturb us. Sometimes people work evil against us and whatnot. And God says, don't worry about it. I'll work it out all for the good. And now we take that as we're going to get some benefit out of this, right? But really, what's the good? The good is for His glory, right? I'm going to work this out so that my kingdom advances. So often we're worried just about ourselves. So Joseph dwelt in the land of Egypt. He and his father's household. And Joseph lived 110 years. Joseph saw Ephraim's children to the third generation, the children of Machir, the son of Manasseh, were also brought up on Joseph's knee. And Joseph said to his brethren, "I am dying, but God will surely visit you and bring you out of the land to a land in which he swore to Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob." And Joseph took an oath from the children of Israel, saying, "God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones from here." So Joseph died, being 110 years old, and they embalmed him, and he was put in a coffin in Egypt. You know, through this whole book here, we see God's grace at work, right? And His will at work, and how He just makes it happen. You know, we see Judah being really not the best of guys, you know, but God somehow works it all out, right? We see Joseph getting thrown into the pit. We see him pulled out of the pit and sold into Egypt. We see him put into being Potiphar's second man and controlled of his household and his all his stuff. And then his wife chases him and whatnot, and he gets thrown into the brink. And, you know, we see all these ups and downs. I mean, talk about going from a depressed state to a state of utopia to a state of depression. You know, you could go as the situation would, you could succumb to the situation and you could find yourself very depressed or find yourself very elated, right? But we find God's plan doesn't doesn't get altered because of people, you know, because of circumstances. But we see God work through all the details right up until the end.